probably the beginning of me changing my philosophy.
We're going to call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Education. Today is March 31st, 2015, and tomorrow we'll have to figure out what Ms. Senator Hass is going to do for April Fool's Day. We aren't going to be here. That's okay. Works out just fine for us. With that,
we're going to be here.
We're going to be here, just not here.
No.
Thank you for the correction. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 487. We'll have a short explanation, and Senator Edwards and whoever you want to bring up with you can come. And
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 487 directs school districts to forward documentation relating to charges resulting in a teacher's termination for failure to meet performance standards or goals to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission for disclosure to potential educational employers. We are not considering any amendments at this time. This bill may have a fiscal impact, but a statement has not yet been issued, and there's no revenue impact for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state senator in Senate District 7, which entails about two-thirds of Eugene and Junction City and a few outlying areas. Senate Bill 487 originates from ongoing discussions that we have had year after year after year in the Ways and Means Subcommittee of Education, or Education Subcommittee, where I no longer serve there, but I served 5 years previously on that subcommittee. And every single time that the TSPC budget would come up for discussion, Senator Girod, and I'm not speaking out of turn here because he said this many, many times on the record, he would go on and on about how there ought to be more, a stronger investigatory and quality function, to teacher quality function, to TSPC. And that's not really the role of TSPC. I mean, they investigate misconduct, and they can take certain actions around misconduct, but really the role in developing teacher performance is really at the building level, you know, with principals, superintendents, folks like that. So, and that makes sense to me, but I don't think that principals and superintendents, those folks that are in charge of the hiring process, really have all the tools at their disposal to make good hiring decisions. So that's the background, and this bill directs the school district to forward documentation relating to charges resulting in teachers' termination for failure to meet performance standards or goals to TSPC for disclosure to potential educational employers. So there's currently a lengthy process for terminating a teacher based on performance issues. After a teacher has been terminated from one school, they can be hired at another school or in another district, possibly without that future employer knowing about the prior termination for performance-based reasons. The personnel files for educators are housed in district offices, and they are inaccessible to future employees or to future employers, and they're non-transferable if a teacher changes districts. So how should future principals make informed decisions regarding who they hire to teach our students? How do we make sure that performance issues become a part of the discussion and the decision process when hiring future employees? In the process of developing this bill and working on it this session, I've come to learn a few things. I've heard that there are online job application tools like, can't remember how you pronounce this, Nechemia or Nechema, I don't know. So, which are used in Oregon by larger districts. They can include questions on their job applications regarding criminal convictions, whether the applicant has been non-renewed, non-extended, if they've resigned in lieu of a termination, or if they've been on a program of assistance, which is, program of assistance is for a teacher who needs to increase their performance and in order to meet standards and remain employed. And POAs are also used as documentation as part of the dismissal process. So However, not all districts can afford to use this online job application tool. Second, principals can do reference checks, and I would say that they ought to. However, if you've ever done a reference check as an employer, you know that you may not get that full of information when you ask, you know, why does this employee not work for you anymore? I know in my previous career in the forest products industry, our business attorney that handled human resource issues always advised us as an employer. They say, you know, well, if you want to stay out of any legal trouble, you know, you can confirm whether or not the employee worked there and then confirm whether or not you would rehire them. But, you know, attorneys would really advise you not to go much further than that. So, and that is a question that is advised of principals often, and that is to ask former employers, would you rehire this employee? So to me, this is a transparency issue. We all pay for educators, although it's not appropriate, I would say, for all of us to be able to see every employee file. I mean, that, and that's not what this bill does. But we ought to give principals and superintendents the tools they need to make more well-informed decisions about who they're hiring. And so that is why I've brought the bill forward, and am eagerly awaiting what type of discussion this will be. This is just one little piece of the issue, and there are issues that this bill doesn't get to, like leaving in lieu of termination, because you're on that track, headed down that road, and I don't know how you get to that unless you were actually to include POAs in that record as well. I think the TSPC is probably not enthused about housing these records, but as we've looked for other potential homes, it still seems like the most appropriate place to me, because TSPC is the place that principals will check in with to find out if the teacher maintains a valid teaching license. So that's the bill, and it's now in your hands.
Any questions for senators? Because I have a few, just because I'll get to some of the ones you basically pointed out. As a principal, I would say that I have very few teachers, let's see how many I can remember, that were actually dismissed for this particular reason, because they chose to resign before that. So this would not get at that. I used to tell the teachers that work with me that I would not sign anything that says I wouldn't disclose information if the school district asked, but I know that a lot of school districts don't ask. So it was an interesting dilemma that I was in with respect to that. But the reality is, I would say the majority of teachers are not dismissed. They resign before that particular case. And I think you mentioned that you don't see how this bill could cover that. I agree that I don't see how it could either. The other one is probationary teachers. In that probationary period of time, you don't have to have cause, so you can just dismiss them. And then, so those would not show up in this, I assume.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's the type. Those are the type of issues,
right,
that I hope to bring up.
Because we got to figure out, does that account?
Yeah.
And the other one is when you, the other issue that is always big for me, because I had to deal with it so often, was all of a sudden you have to let people go because you don't have enough resources to hire them. So there's a reduction in force. And I would hope that that does not show up, because there are many times when people you'd really like to, you think would be better than another person, because of the agreements they have, that's not who you get to keep. So I just want to make sure that we don't affect people who have no control over their employment because of decreasing funds.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this bill would not include dismissal for reductions in force.
And the other thing that has happened from time to time is that they have a right to appeal their decision to the Fair Appeals Board. That doesn't happen overnight. Sometimes it could take a couple of years, and that person may be sitting without a job for those periods of time. How do we expunge that record how do we get it out if, in fact, the appeals board says, sorry, you didn't have what it took to do that? And so the person is either reinstated or an agreement is made that they're going to do something else, but it's already affected their ability to get a job.
Say that again, Mr. Chair.
Fair Appeals Board overrules the school district. And so in that appeal, they can oftentimes say you have to give the job back. That's one. Oftentimes that employer doesn't want to go back to that person because of the whole situation.
Right.
So how does that expunge the record? Because they may not have been able to get a job for those 2 or 3 years while this appeal was going on after they have been, quote, exonerated by the Fair Appeals Board. How do we clear up that record, or does it get cleared up?
I don't have an answer for you right now.
No problem.
But these are the issues that I hope to. This issue, as I've had discussions about it, there are always plentiful reasons why to do nothing. And so the problem remains. Right. I would say that it is still a problem that principals have to make hiring decisions without really, you know, the information that they would appreciate having. So,
okay. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Edwards, I understand what you're trying to do, but it's hard to determine. It's not hard to determine. It's unclear exactly. It says for termination for failure to meet performance standards or goals. Just kind of defining in real world, what does that mean? You know, at the end of the day, how do you deal with conflicts? And how much of the information? It says you have to provide the documentation. You got some issues there, conflict with other statutes in terms of release of personnel records, the requirements to protect those kinds of things. I think you have that. Then my guess is that a lot of this stuff is going to vary by district to district in terms of what's covered under their collective bargaining agreements. You may have some conflicts there, and I'm not sure. I suppose statute could supersede that, but you got contract right issues there that I think might get in the way as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, statute could supersede collective bargaining agreements, but and perhaps not current collective bargaining agreements, but future collective bargaining agreements would be negotiated under new laws, under current law. So to your comment about there is a process for dismissing a teacher and putting them on a program of assistance, and that can be a somewhat subjective process anyway. I am told by people in the profession, such as the good chair, that is not necessarily a short process, but can take a good deal of time. And so it deals with dismissals. You know, after you've gone through that process, if you've been dismissed for those performance reasons, then this would apply.
Mm-hmm. And I would say the last comment I make is that there are times when performance issues arise because of the environment you're in and your school. So I have had teachers who I believed shouldn't have been at the school, and I put them on plans and we've worked things out. Or they've left because they really didn't have control of the classroom, and you can't teach much if the kids are not under control. I have worked with them and heard from other school districts where they went that were very small school districts, because these were really intelligent, good people who, when they went to the school district and they had a class of 15, they were exceptional teachers and their kids did exceptionally well. So that's the other part about, I would probably not recommend that particular person for a class of 35. In this other situation, they might be really exceptional. And that's part of the ongoing issue that we have with evaluations. But I appreciate the conversation. Because I think we all want to have the best possible people in every position in our state. And I would say my unions want the same thing. Everybody wants that, because the truth is you have fewer and fewer problems if the best people are there doing the best job they possibly can for all of our kids.
I agree, Mr. Chair, and I do recognize that there are challenges when you start to try to, you know, put certain things in the law, whether they be requirements or prohibitions. It affects things. What has frustrated me is, as I've seen, in my own son's school career, he's had a lot of great teachers. There's only one teacher who, frankly, I thought wasn't a good teacher. But, he's had mostly great teachers. Those teachers that aren't good, and not every teacher is a great teacher, okay? Just like I was going to say legislator.
I figured you were going there, yeah.
Not every, let's see, I'm trying to think of the most, I'll just leave it at that. Not every person in any given profession is great at what they do.
Perfect.
Teachers hold a special place in our workforce. Yeah. I mean, they are charged with the education and nurturing of our children, and I can't think of a more important job. The conversations are uncomfortable and we're not sure about this or that, we have attempted in the state and have done some good things around teacher training, which I think are really, really important. It's not just the teachers, frankly, it's the principals too. It's leadership from the state level through the building, building administration to the classroom. Leadership matters on these issues. And I think we need to have these conversations. And if we can find a better way, then we need to do that.
Okay. Well, and because you brought up administrators, and I'm one of those people who get myself in trouble at times with fellow administrators, because I think if you're doing your job as an administrator and a leader in a building, and you identify an issue that needs to change for that person to stay, there is no reason for you not to take actions and to do the things. And if you do them appropriately, follow the rules that you have, you have all the tools you need to make that teacher either, in your eyes, get better or not be there. And sometimes we don't do that. I didn't say that was easy. It's very difficult, but it goes back to your leadership issue. You have to decide it's that important. But, and I agree with you, every child deserves the best they can have in their classroom. And so it becomes a leadership problem.
And the reason, Mr. Chair, that this bill focuses on teachers and not principals is because the discussion that we had year after year in the Ed Sub about TSPC,
right,
and the role that TSPC, what one committee member felt their role ought to be, and actually disagreed with that, but that kind of led to this further conversation about, do principals have the tools that they need? So,
thank you. No other questions. I appreciate
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. So we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 487. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 79. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator, and then I will entertain a motion.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 79 requires school districts to provide instruction in CPR and the use of automated external defibrillators. This bill has no subsequent referral by prior reference. We are considering the -5 amendments at this time. And Senate Bill 79 with the -5 amendments has a minimal fiscal impact statement issued to ODE, but an indeterminate impact to school districts. Senate Bill 79 with the -5 amendments has no revenue impact.
So, I will entertain a motion.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the -5 amendments as presented.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the -5 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion? I just want to say I really appreciated the first responders coming and telling us that anywhere we are in the state, we'd be glad to come and help in every school, and don't forget to ask us. We'd like to be there to help understand how to do hands-only CPR, and all the districts that came and testified said they had overwhelming response from their first responders to be there to help make this happen. Is there any opposition to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 79 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 79 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any opposition? Seeing none, it is moved. Is there anyone who wants to carry this bill on the floor?
I think Senator Hess should carry that.
Okay. Senator Hess will carry that bill.
Just to continue.
That's right.
Every session.
That's right. That's true. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 79. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 287. And we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 287 deletes the provision that authorizes teachers licensed by the TSPC to practice speech-language pathology without a license from the State Board of Examiners for speech pathology and audiology. This bill has no subsequent referral by prior reference. There are no amendments at this time. A minimal fiscal statement has been issued, and there is no revenue impact.
So, again, we heard this testimony, and it's really lining some things up, which everybody seems to have agreed with. I think it does give those people who, that's the certificate they have right now is from TSPC, they get to retain that, but eventually everybody will be certified through the board. So, with that, I would entertain a motion, Senator Knope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 287 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, is passed. Is there anyone who would like to carry this bill? Senator Cruz. We'll close our work session on Senate Bill 287. And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 473. We're ready, right? 473, and we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 473 requires the higher education institutions to allow the identification of sexual orientation and preferred first names on certain forms. This bill has no subsequent referral by prior reference. We are considering the Dash 3 amendments at this time. Senate Bill 473 with the Dash 3 amendments does have a fiscal impact of approximately $53,000. That statement was just issued. It should now be posted on OLIS. And they have requested that we add a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Senate Bill 473 with the Dash 3 amendments has no revenue impact.
So I'll entertain a motion.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments as presented.
Senator Hess moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion on the Dash 3 amendments? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the Dash 3 amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted. Senator Hess.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 473 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Hass moves Senate Bill 473 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Senator Bearsugar.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. You know, this is a tough bill for me. I'm going to vote no on it in committee simply because I don't like categorizing people anyways. I've been like that all my life, and I don't like categorizing people by their race or their orientation or anything. I mean, people are just people to me, and I don't think this is as productive as some people think. So I'll be a no vote in committee.
Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also will be a no. I think Senator Bertschinger makes a good point, but my focus of part of the session has been about privacy, and I don't think it's any business of a university or anybody else, who somebody's sleeping with or any of that. And if this bill simply said that universities can't ask that question, I'd be all over it. But I think this broadens it out, and the fact that that information is voluntary also I don't think is going to give you a good idea of the factual information that people are looking for anyway. And so, you know, it would be my preference that universities and government entities don't ask for this information at all, because I don't think it's any of their business.
Thank you. Further questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I absolutely agree that privacy is important, and one of the features of this bill is that nobody's required to provide the information. It's voluntary. What is persuasive to me, and the reason that I introduced the bill, is that the students that this would impact asked for this. And I think for many people, and I can't speak for the LGBT community, but what's been told to me is that it's not just about who you're dating, or it's a really a matter of identity and kind of identity as a whole person. I think the other element of this bill that's important, part of the element of our whole identity, is our name, and being able to be called what we want to be called when we want to be called that is really important. But again, it's very voluntary, and that privacy is protected because it rests with each individual person to decide whether or not they want to share that information about who they are. And so I'm really grateful to you for scheduling the bill and look forward to seeing it on the floor eventually.
And my only comment is that I appreciate the group of students who brought this and their willingness to work with the community colleges and others to come up with a plan, and the Dash 3 amendments allow them to do this in a fairly inexpensive way. We have a kind of a rule that says if it's over $50,000, this is right at the deal, that it's going to go to Ways and Means, and I believe in following that kind of pattern. It used to be a lot more than that, but our tight budgets has required that every penny being spent, that they have a chance to look at it and put it into the budget. So
it's been 50 for quite a while.
It has. Yeah. But when I first got here, it wasn't. But that's been 10 years ago. So with that, we'll do a roll call. Any other discussion? Seeing none, a roll call vote.
Senator Barrett-Sugar?
No.
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Gelser?
Yes.
Senator Haas?
Yes.
No.
Vice Chair Knope?
No.
And Chair Wilburn?
Yes. Bill passes. Senator Gelser, do you want to carry? Oh, this is going to Ways and Means.
It's going to Ways and Means.
On its way to Ways and Means. Okay. So we don't need a carrier. We will close Senate Bill 473 work session. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 521. And we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 521 permits a coach to allow a member of a school athletic team or non-school athletic team to participate in an athletic event or training at any time after an athletic trainer has determined that that member has not suffered a concussion. There is no subsequent referral by prior reference. We are not considering amendments at this time. The bill has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
So with that, we'll hear a, do you want to do this one?
Sure. Okay. Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 521 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 521 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I guess the only thing that I wanted to say on this bill was that it really made sense to align the two bills that we have with respect to concussions, because those teams play each other. So if people don't understand, what's happening right now is if I was from a private school, high school, participating in an event, and another team was a public high school, the private school, high school, if the official sent the student out because of a concussion, could not return, regardless of whether he had a concussion or not, would not be able to come back because of the rules relating to private schools. Whereas the student was at the public school, if there was a person there that could ascertain whether they had a concussion, after deciding that it was there was no concussion, could send them back in. And the people didn't feel that it was fair to treat one group of athletes in the same contest differently than the other. And so this was a way to fix that and make it the same for everybody participating in the same event. And I appreciate the OSA recognizing this problem over the last number of years since we passed the two different bills, and making sure that they lined them back up so that we would have an understanding and treat people the same way. So, with that, is there any opposition to this bill? Seeing none, it is passed. Anybody that wished to carry this bill? Senator Steiner Haywood will be carrying the bill. So with that, we will close our work session on Senate Bill 521, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 560. We'll have a short explanation, and yes, Senator Gelser can go out. And if there's anybody else you want with you, invite them up.
In
anybody that wants to join me is welcome to this.
So Shane Jackson, Susan Farmer, if you want to come up, you can come on up if ever you want to do that.
So go ahead.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 560 establishes timelines by which evaluations must be completed to determine eligibility for special education. There is no subsequent referral. This bill is no amendments at this time. It may have a fiscal impact, but a statement has not yet been issued, and there is no revenue impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which is Albany, Corvallis, Philomath, and surrounding areas. And for the record, I don't know what Mr. Farmer Jackson is going to say. So Senate Bill, I brought up the wrong bill, which is great. Senate Bill 560 is the bill about timelines for special education evaluation. This is the problem that we are trying to solve. Thank you, Senator Cruz. When a student is referred for special education evaluation, the reason the student has been referred is that the student is having difficulty at school. Something is not working right. If you think back a couple weeks ago, we had the hearing on the dyslexia bill, and you listen to those students talk about the relief that they felt after they had an evaluation and understood why school was so hard for them. It wasn't that they were dumb. It wasn't that they were doing anything wrong. There was a real barrier for them that required specially designed instruction. And that's why we have evaluations for special education. Once you're found eligible, it isn't just a label. It means that you will be provided with specially designed instruction that will allow you to access and make progress in the general curriculum so that you can graduate from high school, hopefully by the time that you get done. The problem in Oregon is that we have, as you know, one of the shortest school years in the country. We also have many weeks in which we have days off school, and we have a standard for special education evaluation, which is 60 school days, that your evaluation must be completed within 60 school days. Someone brought this to my attention a couple of years ago, and I thought 2 months, you know, it's a little long, but, you know, it takes time to do these things. And then I went back and plotted it out against calendars of a variety of school districts. And I want you to think for a minute about the second grader that has been referred because they aren't meeting their reading benchmarks. They're struggling to get along, so they're falling behind in all of their classes. They get referred in November. It may be after spring break before that evaluation occurs. If you are a student and your referral for evaluation happens in March, you may not get your evaluation until September of the next school year, mid to late September of the next school year. When you think about that second grader or that third grader and all of that learning time that they are losing by not having the appropriate services, that is a very significant problem for that student. That is a lot of learning time that's been lost, and it's also a lot of time for that student to sit there feeling about themselves the way that you heard the students that came to talk about the dyslexia screening talking about themselves, and it's feeling about themselves, and it's very difficult to recover that time. Senate Bill 560 would, as it's written, and I have a proposed amendment, would ask that that evaluation be done within 60 calendar days. So that really would be within 2 months. This bill, there's some bills in the House, and I understand that there are some negotiations that are going to do some different things over there unrelated to timelines. But this bill provides breaks in that calendar, in that calculation of 60 days, so that if school is out for 2 weeks, that 2 weeks doesn't count against the school district. When you're out for the summer, that doesn't count. The clock stops. The proposed amendments to the bill would do a couple of things. One, it would clarify that if a student is scheduled for their evaluation on the appropriate timeline and they don't show up for school that day, the clock can, we're still negotiating whether the clock would restart or it would be a couple of weeks that were added onto that time. That's something that's out of the control of the school district. The second thing is to push out the implementation a little bit. This bill will not change the number of students that need to be evaluated for special education services, but it would create a little bit of a workload issue at the front end when you're implementing it, because you'll have the new kids and then the old kids that are already evaluated. So we're talking about grandfathering in any kid that's already been referred for special education services on the effective date of the bill, and then slowly phasing in kids that come in the year after that. So there's a time period for districts to start to transition into this different time period. period. And then the final proposed change after meeting with education folks is to change it to 75 calendar days instead of 60 calendar days, which gives you about 2.5 months, which should be enough time to be able to get that done. The difference between calendar days and school days really is significant when you look at those number of days that kids aren't in school. You look at weekends, you look at 3-day weekend holidays, and it's not about the convenience for the parents. It's about how that kid is feeling about themselves and the services that they are receiving. And I think those that it impacts the most, I know we're going to hear from some folks today that have kids with autism, with some behavioral issues, with more visible kinds of disabilities. Those kids that I think this bill will impact the most are those kids that were filling in this hearing room on that dyslexia day. Those kids that really do need that specially designed instruction that's going to help them in their regular classroom be able to not fall further behind by waiting for 6 months before they can even start the conversation about what help they need.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Gelser? Because then we can let her come on back up here.
Thank you.
Miss Mr. Jackson, right? Is it Shane? Yeah. Go ahead.
Chair Roblin, thank you very much. My name is Shane Jackson. I'm the lobbyist for the Autism Society of Oregon. Autism Society of Oregon advocates for the 9,000 students with a autism IEP in the state of Oregon. We're here today to talk about this bill, and we really support this bill. I think what we've gotten to here is a very good discussion. We also have a bill on the House side, House Bill 2673. We've been working equally as constructive with that bill, bringing language that is acceptable for everybody. I would love to have some kind of meeting where we can talk about what we've accomplished over there on the House side and what we've accomplished on the Senate side and merge those two items. There's a little bit of a mitigating issue in that House Bill 2673 also has another component that we would also like to see come over into this bill or on its own and maybe merge some of the ideas that includes a summary of services that we feel is very essential for a parent. What Senator Gelser said to you today was completely correct. We need to have a better timeline. We need to give parents more certainty of when these IEPs will start. Right now, if a person was to go into the Portland Public School District, request an IEP on the first day of school, it wouldn't be done until December 4th. So if all 90 days were taken. Many IEPs don't take all that time. I think that's I look forward to seeing the information that she's developed over here on this side and see what we can pull together. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. So with that, we'll have Todd Nicholson, George Winterscheid, and Tracy Stewart come on up. So we'll start with Todd.
Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin, members of the Senate Committee. My name is Todd Nicholson, and I'm a school psychologist in the Beaverton School District. I've been a school psychologist for 12 years, and I've worked directly with students, parents, as well as multidisciplinary evaluation and intervention teams. My professional life has been dedicated to improving educational outcomes for all kids, and especially those that are most vulnerable. Senate Bill 560, with the proposed amendments changing initial and reevaluation timelines from 60 school days to 60 calendar days, would have a tremendous negative effect on the quality of the evaluation, as well as the quality and the appropriateness of the interventions for students eligible for special education. Students are referred for special education consideration by school staff, as well as parents, when students are suspected of having an educational disability. When students are referred, special education staff is required by law to meet and consider an evaluation. Evaluations and components are laid out in the OARs and are specific to this specific or the suspected disability. Some of these evaluation categories have as few as 4 components, and others have as many as 9 components. Beyond required components, it's not unusual for additional assessments to be necessary to further identify the student's needs and to guide the interventions to help students make progress. This means that some evaluations can be relatively brief and others more extensive and complex and include the participation of medical providers in the community. I fully understand the spirit of this proposed change to more quickly identify and serve students who may be eligible for special education. Yet shortening the timeline as proposed will have a serious negative effect on these same students. Psychoeducational evaluations are much different from psychological evaluations available in the community. The chief difference being that psychoeducational evaluations are tailored specifically to the educational concerns of the child referred. For example, in addition to evaluating a struggling student's cognitive processes, which can typically be done in 1 to 2 days in the community, the educational evaluation must also seek to systematically analyze and evaluate the student's interaction with his or her environment. This takes time. The better and the more comprehensive an evaluation, the better and more informed the educational interventions. Taking shortcuts in this area leads to more educational failure, and the student would likely be given imprecise interventions and experience more failure. I am also concerned that English language learner students would be inappropriately identified as having a disability when they appear, when they are actually temporarily appear delayed due to their language acquisition. Without a doubt, you're going to receive lots of comments from other educators and administrators, which will speak to the considerable burden this will place on an already stretched special education system. I agree with these concerns and fear that overall, students will receive less instructional time. The professionals who conduct these evaluations also provide interventions and direct services. And to meet this 60-day calendar timeline, would put special educators in the position of not being able to serve either students being evaluated or students receiving interventions appropriately. I was recently involved in a complex evaluation for a student who was found eligible for special education services under the autism spectrum disorder category. This evaluation necessitated 9 specialists coordinating over 60 hours of evaluation. Of the 60 hours of evaluation, 74% of that time consisted of direct interaction with the student, and the remaining time was spent in observing the student interacting with the educational environment and then synthesizing all of that information for eligibility and intervention. In reality, if this new timeline were applied, the team would have had actually less than 43 school days to complete the evaluation when you take into account weekends, holidays, and absences. And of course, that is very dependent on the time of year that it happens and when the breaks are. Another concern as a school psychologist is that when assessment is compressed into a short time frame, students experience test fatigue. And this not only compromises the integrity of the evaluations being conducted, but also really affects the student's perception of herself. Sometimes that there is a perception that students are not receiving interventions during an evaluation process. This is simply not true. Tiered instruction, or what is commonly called response to intervention, is designed to provide appropriate instruction along the continuum of needs. And the majority of schools that I know of are in the process of doing this and making this response to intervention more better, so to speak. A wise educator once remarked, if the necessary groundwork for any intervention has not been laid, then the likelihood that that intervention will be successful is greatly reduced. Comprehensive and thoughtful evaluation lays that groundwork, and I urge you to consider these and other unintended consequences of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. need a pool.
Yeah, just both of those. About a foot away is fine.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the Senate Committee on Education. My name is George Winterscheid, and I am the Director of Special Student Services at Northwest Regional ESD, headquartered in Hillsboro. At Northwest Regional ESD, we work with and provide support to the 20 school districts of Northwest Oregon in Tillamook, Clatsop, Columbia, and Washington counties. My goal is to briefly share with you the concerns with a reduced timeline for a comprehensive special education evaluation as proposed in Senate Bill 560. So I have submitted to you a detailed written testimony, and I won't go into that or read through that. So I'm going to just go to a kind of a summary of those points. Reduced timelines for comprehensive special education evaluation will not result in better or more accurate evaluations. In fact, they are likely to result in the opposite, less adequate and more inaccurate evaluations. For the most vulnerable student populations, reduced timelines for evaluations will likely result in increased misidentification of students whose problems are due to factors other than a disability, for example, English language learners. Allocation of resources necessary to shorten the timeline for comprehensive special education evaluations will not increase the capacity of our educational system to effectively teach all children. Rather, it will likely result in reduced provision of services for students. Provisions in Senate Bill 560 for reduced evaluation timelines will not improve educational outcomes for Oregon students. And on a very brief note, I've been fortunate to work it within education for over 30 years now, and as a teacher, as a counselor, as a school psychologist, and as an administrator now, and a parent throughout that whole time. And what's really important to me, what's a passion to me as an educator who wants to support students for success, is to get it right. And appropriate evaluations are, as they're noted in federal law, they need to be comprehensive, and they're populated with multiple specialists, especially for the students with the highest needs. And I think that it's without question that takes thoughtful, considered time to make sure that the interventions, and especially the consideration of eligibility for special ed, is appropriately considered. Special education evaluation does not inevitably lead to special education eligibility. For the request of an IEP, it still needs to go through the process of what's appropriate for the student. So there's without question in my mind, if anything, I would say that we need to make sure that there's plenty of time to get our evaluations correct, especially with those students with complex needs, for example, students with autism. The primary factors in an autism evaluation are observations over time and in different settings, and that takes a good deal of time. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Yes, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I appreciate the issue about wanting to have the evaluations done appropriately to design the best interventions. But wouldn't it be possible to do the base evaluation for eligibility for special education? Doesn't the team continue to have the ability to continue looking at the students' needs to build out that plan moving forward? But at least by identifying earlier on eligibility or not eligibility, you could get the basic interventions in, the behavioral protections for kids that would be on an IEP due to behavioral or autism issues, for less complicated kids, intervention happening more quickly.
So I think I understand what you're asking, and to me the response is that in the process of evaluating a student, for example, parent signed consent, that's when the timeline begins. If you know that student has needs, you are helping that student during that time, whether or not it results in an eligibility finding or not. For example, if you get to the end of the timeline and appropriately have all the assessments together and you can have a good thoughtful discussion about it, if you find that the student's not eligible, that wouldn't mean that you wouldn't then help them or provide intervention or support. Those students demonstrate a need for support. So I don't know if that's answering
not
your question. But
may I try one more time?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair? Thank you.
Excuse me.
And I think that that's right. And I appreciate and believe that, people are at school because they care about kids and they want to help them and they're going to do everything that they can to support them. But we do have special education services to provide a different level of supports. Those come with different resources. If I go to the doctor and I'm sick, I have terrible stomach pains, he treats me and determines that I'm eligible for treatment before I have the MRI and the gallbladder taken out and everything else. I don't have to wait until everything is done. So I guess what I was trying to get at, you talked about having worse outcomes for kids because maybe you wouldn't be able to do as many assessments. But once a kid's in the door for special ed, they're in the door. They really only need one assessment to determine that they're eligible for special ed. Why not just do that one, get them in the door, have the IEP team together, or alternately, would you support amending the bill to make sure every student has a provisional IEP that's in place for the duration of the assessment period?
Senator Kelser, Chair Roblin, I think that you also have to consider the educational impact and whether or not that student needs specially designed instruction. And you actually have to consider that finding that student eligible could be harmful to that student because the consideration of least restrictive environment is critical. And so it doesn't necessarily follow that to find them eligible is the best thing for that student. And that's part of what federal law directs us to do. So finding them eligible, first of all, wouldn't or not, doesn't preclude them from having support services. And it also, as a team, you have to determine, is this in the best interest of the student to be eligible for special education? For example, there are students with on the spectrum with autism disorder that require, or the team with parent involvement, that's always critical, obviously, that they need a 504, Section 504 of the ADA, they need a 504 plan. And that's what is best for their success. So that doesn't say, well, special education, which would then be sort of a more significant intervention, is appropriate for them. I still don't feel like I might have answered your question.
I don't quite understand the connection between eligibility and least restrictive environment, because I'm assuming being found eligible for special education doesn't mean we're sending everybody down to the self-contained classroom.
Well, it's a very fine point and complex to consider least restrictive environment. I hope the earlier legislation about AEDs, my heart's going a little bit fast here.
We haven't had the training yet.
Okay, I'm going to try to slow my breath down. The least restrictive environment isn't necessarily, it's whatever's best for that student. That could be in a special setting. It could be inclusive in a, as we say, mainstream or regular education classroom. And so if it seems that identifying a student was to be eligible for special education support services, if you think that compared to the support that you could give without that eligibility would be harmful, potentially, then what is best for the student that's what you consider, whether it's eligibility or not. And so it could be, you could say, well, finding them eligible for special education is too restrictive or potentially harmful. That's interpretation.
We'll have that last person and we'll ask any questions, but thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Tracy D. Stewart. I reside in Silverton, Oregon. I am here to wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 560. My husband and I, who were were ecstatic empty nesters, were called in August and asked to raise our great nephew. We knew that it was going to be challenging. However, we didn't expect that schooling was going to be the biggest obstacle that we would encounter. He started school just after Thanksgiving of this year. His behaviors directly related to a disability, emotional disturbance, stemming from PTSD, from his unfortunate treatment. He went started school, and then he was asked to not return the last 2 days before Christmas. So basically he attended 3 days before the Christmas break. They asked him to not come the last 2 days. We didn't want him to miss the Christmas festivities, so we asked if we could attend with him on those 2 days. They said yes. So we went to school with him on those days. We have been awaiting eligibility for him. School is, because he is under IDEA, they are not providing protection. So under the IDEA, there is no limit to how many times a child can be removed or how long a child, what the removal from school is. He returned after Christmas break. He had a serious incident at school, not harming anyone, but hearing a siren and triggered some stuff for him. He ran because of hearing the siren. He was then removed from school except for 1 hour after school tutoring. That's all he was allowed to have. He continued that for the after-school tutoring for several weeks. We then asked if there was a way that he could attend school during the day if we attended. They said yes. So my husband and I, who are professionals, we both have full-time jobs. We had to start somehow rearranging our schedule, showing up in school so that he would be able to be there. He would leave after 10:15 in the morning. He would be home all day until 2:30 after school, where he would go to school for that 1 hour one-on-one just with the teacher. My husband and I, as I said, we've had huge loss of hours. My income is 50% of what it was previous to taking our great nephew in. I am on FMLA at this time. I am very, very concerned about my FMLA running out. and thus losing my full-time status, benefits, and everything else that goes with that status, as I'm sure you can understand. My husband is falling further and further behind in his job at a very critical time, and he's also concerned for his profession. Our child basically has no socialization through school other than what we as parents provide for him. We requested an increased attendance from the school district. The school refused a full day, offering 3 hours, saying that they would place someone in the classroom with him during that time. He received at that time also a typical child punitive behavioral plan, and we were told that he must reach 80% of the behavior listed. If he did not, over that three-week period, receive 80% on that behavioral plan, he would have his 3 hours reduced by 45 minutes each time. Any incident that he occurs on a specific day immediately loses 45 minutes of attendance. He then, by losing that 45 minutes of attendance, has to gain that 80% over the next 3 weeks to gain any 45 minutes back. The child's emotional damage. Obviously, he was already damaged when we received him. He now is, in my opinion, even more damaged. He feels rejected from the school. He feels isolated from his peers. He has no friends, and he has been suspended probably 8 times over that period of time, even in a small amount, because he doesn't have support in the classroom. We have tried to enroll him in other activities. He is in. He's been in concurrent swim lessons, Boy Scouts, Lego Club, acting, and dance. At this time, we are even putting more hours out of our time to try to gain socialization that he would otherwise receive in the school that he's not getting. Because of the rejection that he feels at the school, he has a greater anxiety upon going there in the mornings now. He's afraid that he's not going to be able to make a full day and feels that he's a failure before he even arrives in the door. We are at this point, we received the child in November. We are still awaiting eligibility right now, still awaiting eligibility. We asked for all this back in November and we're still waiting. Our frustration with waiting for the eligibility and an IEP has caused great stress for my husband and I and our child, which in turn, because of the two of us are so stressed, we try to prevent it from spilling out on him, but in some ways it does cause frustration, and we're trying not to feel resentment and give him you know, the possibilities that he deserves. We're asking for this to be expedited, for the eligibility and the IEP to be expedited further, especially in the case of behavior and discipline. There is a word listed in there as about expedited for discipline and behavior. However, there is no definition of what expedited means. We'd like to have clarity on what that is, days, hours, whatever that means. We are finally having an eligibility meeting that is happening this Thursday. And you may say to yourself, what age is this child? In your mind, perhaps you're picturing a middle schooler or maybe a high school student, but I will tell you that this child is 7, and he's a first grader. He is extremely bright. He has the highest reading test score in the first grade. He is very bright. He is aware of what's going on in his surroundings. This child deserves an education with support services, and by decreasing the time required to provide those services will increase his ability to get on with his life and flourish and not sit at home and feel rejected and friendless. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be very happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. We have Susan Farmer, and is there anyone else that wanted to testify that didn't sign up? I see no one.
Mr. Chair, while she's coming up, can I just mention to this person, we've got a bill on the floor next week that will address part of that, that would eliminate any out-of-school suspension for kids K through 5, period.
Yeah. Wise recommendation. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and Senate Committee on Education members. I support Senate Bill 560. I'm Susan Farmer, a licensed teacher trained in special education law, and I advocate for special ed children and their parents. My credentials are listed on the copy that you have. In 2004, federal law adopted a 60 calendar day timeline, a voluntary guide. In 2007, a colleague of mine personally went and visited the sites of every single state law and did her own research and found the timelines for every state. Those are copied to you in your copy. Oregon was one of only 5 states left which failed to adopt the federal 60-day timeline. 9 states have even shorter timelines than 60 days, including our neighbor in Washington with 35 school days, which amounts to about 47 calendar days on an average month without holidays. Neighboring California also has 60 calendar days. Special education directors have offered testimony here and online claiming that staff would be unable to perform the appropriate student evaluations if 560 passes. Yet 45 other states can and do. One district claims an annual $1 million cost increase just to get staff to do quicker evaluations. That makes no sense because the bill isn't increasing the number of students, as Senator Gelser pointed out. It's only increasing the timeline. Shorter timelines do mean quicker help, and that's the way it should be. Although districts claim a critical staff shortage, I know specialists who refuse to work in the schools because the children are being denied sufficient services. Attracting qualified staff could require an improvement in serving the children. I'm disturbed by online testimony from directors saying they will reduce and even remove services to special needs children if 560 passes. Read it, it's there. Please see this testimony. Since these children have services prescribed and listed on a legal IEP document, the only way to legally reduce these services is to go and alter the child's IEP to claim the child's needs are less than what he's currently getting, so that their staff can supposedly go do the evaluations. These directors just wrote exhibit number one for any child whose services get reduced and a parent wants to seek legal action. A shortened timeline will not increase the number of students needing evaluations, and statements claiming to withdraw legally required services to Oregon's children is egregious. Surely the other 45 states, 90% of our nation, which have shorter timelines than Oregon, have not needed to increase their 60 calendar day timelines. And again, 9%, which is approximately, or not 9%, 9 states, approximately 20%, have even fewer calendar days. It's time for Oregon to join the 90% of the nation. I'm opposed to meeting in the middle and changing this to 70 days. 60 calendar days is far efficient for them. 90% of the nation is already doing it. 60 school days is a third of the school year, so it's got to be changed, as people have pointed out. I sincerely appreciate your time and attention. The statistics that I provided to you are documented on my online testimony and in your copy. One particular person mentioned RTI. I assume most of you know what RTI is, where you're supposed to be trying interventions. There is, not in your attached copy, I don't believe, but in the OLIS copy, there is a ruling from the U.S. Department of Education done in 2011, which states that schools are forbidden from withholding evaluations from children during the RTI process if a requested evaluation has been made. They are not allowed to stop. So the U.S. Department of Education, not allowed to make this drawn-out process. The U.S. Department of Ed has directed states, get in there and do that evaluation and get this eligible. Get these children eligible or not, but find out what's going on and identify these students. One thing I wanted to point out is I had requested a consideration of a couple of additional amendments to add to this bill, because I think it's a very, very opportune time to do this. It's the very same section of the law, just adding a B and C to it. I want this committee here to know that when a parent requests an evaluation from the school district, they have to legally give a written consent. Now, I, as an advocate, I kid you not, I hear from at least one parent a month calling me. I'm sorry if I get to tears, because this is very emotional for me. I went through the same thing with my child. I go to the school and I say, my daughter's having trouble. Can you evaluate her? You will be surprised at the teachers who will tell their parent, oh, nothing's wrong. They can't possibly. Or we have to wait until they're at least 2 or 3 years before they can have an evaluation. They wouldn't possibly qualify for special education right now. You know, they're just not far enough behind. And the parent buys this information. It is so far out of federal compliance, it's not. It's just totally ridiculous. I am very, very concerned that parents, when they go and voice concerns to the teacher, are buying into what the teachers have been told from higher up that they don't need to do anything. Parents don't know they need to sign a consent. The school teacher says, we can't evaluate right now. Sorry, they have to be 2 or 3 years behind. And that's not true. There's no law that says that. If a parent has a concern, they have a right to request an evaluation. But they don't know they have to sign the legal consent. They're just going and saying, can I get an evaluation? Finally, 2 years goes by. They beg and they beg and they beg. And finally, the teacher's green. Yeah, this child's far enough behind. And then they start the evaluation process. And they come and they say, okay, let's have a meeting. And they come and they have this meeting. And they say, okay, well, sure, we'll do this evaluation. Now sign. Oh, now we have 60 days more. They've already waited for a year, 2 years, 6 months, whatever it was, during all this time, and nobody ever told them they needed to sign a consent form. Nobody. I propose that this changes. California requires it. I copied in your copy. Pennsylvania requires it. When a parent comes and requests a test, that parent within 10 days, I proposed, before I read these, I proposed 10 calendar days, that the parent is given the opportunity to sign the consent form. That's what California requires. That's what Pennsylvania requires. I copied Pennsylvania's for you. The parent is given that. I do know that that's going to really raise some flack with the school districts because they want to do that in a meeting, and that's going to put some shortchanging on them.
I'm going to ask you to wrap it up fairly quickly.
Okay, it is, very rapidly. I'm proposing that within 10 calendar days that the parent is given the opportunity to schedule a meeting so that they can, within 21 calendar days, have the opportunity to sign that consent. They don't need to be waiting and waiting and waiting for 6 months to a year. So I suggested in some copies I put in Pennsylvania's there. I'm perfectly willing to look up and give people copies of what other states are doing in this area. Pennsylvania's the absolute strictest.
We got it.
10 days. But I appreciate your time. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Seeing none, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 560. We're going to skip over one right now, 619. We're going to go to 709 because I know there's a bunch of people here for 709, and we'll see what we can get done. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 709. And with that, we'll have our chief sponsor, Senator Gelser, make a few comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Gelser, State Senator from Senate District 8. I do have the correct bill file in front of me this time. Lessons learned. Senate Bill 709 needs a lot of amendments. We don't have an amendment for you today because we wanted to get the input of the committee before we had Hannah start to draft the amendments because this is a very complicated area of the law. I wanted to start by describing what the bill does and make very clear what the bill does not do. Over the last several sessions, we have had a lot of conversations about how students move from district to district. As a result, we have a large number of ways that students can move from district to district. And that has become relatively cumbersome and confusing for families and students that want to move and for schools that are trying to administer them. Senate Bill 709 is trying to do a couple of things, primarily make it easier, make the transfer process less confusing. A couple of key elements that we want to preserve from legislation that we passed last session is the non-discrimination portion of transfers, that a district cannot say, you cannot move out of my district because of any of your personal characteristics, whether that's the amount of money your family makes or what language you speak or the fact that you have a disability or the color of your skin. And the same is true for allowing a student to come into the district. So it maintains those same requirements. One of the problems that we've seen is that when a student transfers from one district to another district, they have to get permission from both the district that they live in and to release them and the district that they are going to accept them. And what we have found
is that there are some districts that are saying, we will take students into our district, but we are not going to let anybody leave. Senate Bill 709 is attempting to address that issue by requiring that even in the interdistrict transfer process, every district allow some students to leave. And that number should be either at a minimum a percentage, or at least the same, they should allow at least the same number of kids that they've identified that they are going to allow to come back in. So you can't call people in from other districts and not be willing to let your kids go to others. The bill would, in the proposed amendments that we've talked about, would have the Department of Ed establish by rule some timelines so that there's less confusion. I apply to go to Senator Hass's district, and I ask permission to leave Senator Roblin's district. There needs to be some way to align those two elements. So as a family, I'm not waiting for a month or two because I have permission from one, and I don't know yet if the other one is going to allow me to move. We also want to make sure that students, once they have arrived in a new school district, that they're allowed to stay there. That if the family, for instance, lives in Philomath and they get a transfer into Albany, and they are in Albany, they've been approved to stay in Albany through the end of high school, and then they move to Lebanon, they shouldn't have to go to Lebanon and get permission to stay in Albany. We want to make sure that that student has the permanency of being in that district that they have chosen to move to. We also want to make sure that students, the current transfer law allows a student to stay in the district they're attending through the end of the school year if they move during a school year. If a student moves over the course of a summer, they may not have had time to prepare to move into that new district, and they will have missed the transfer deadlines. So this would allow students to stay in the district they were attending in that following year when they have moved. This bill does not do a couple of things. It does not impact virtual charter schools in any way, or charter schools. It does not impact schools that charge tuition. This is specifically in the area of the law. Remember, I mentioned we have lots of ways that students can move. This is specifically in the part about inter-district transfer. It also does not touch open enrollment. In some ways, this will make interdistrict transfer even a little bit more open than Oregon's open enrollment law. The bill came together, and there's people here to speak with you, superintendents from across the state, Oregon School Boards Association, and the genesis of the bill was after we passed House Bill 2447. I almost forgot the bill number, which would be amazing. That took a lot of time last session. After House Bill 2447, OSBA traveled around the state to talk to school districts about the implementation of the bill. We had a couple of cleanups last February, and this really would create a nice clean process. As you listen to the others, please be sure to let us know what you're concerned about in the bill. As I mentioned, we didn't want Hannah to start drafting the amendments because this is very complicated, and I know the workload down there is very heavy, but we will be ready to put those in, and Morgan and the superintendents will be able to answer questions. I think the only non-negotiable in the bill is an unwillingness to undo in any way the non-discrimination language that would allow districts to pick and choose or cherry pick the kids that they're either allowing to come in or the kids that they are allowing to leave. And I'm happy to answer questions or leave it to Morgan and his superstar team.
Any questions right now? Nope. Then we will call up Morgan and Karen to begin with. And then we've got a number. Hello, Karen. Great to see you again. A number of groups that will come, and we'll go back and forth between people who are in favor and against. And nobody listed over 100 miles, so that's a nice thing. So we'll just kind of go down the list after that. So, and try to keep yours as succinct as you can so that we can get everybody's testimony in today. So with that.
Right on. I'm Karen Fisher Gray, and I'm the superintendent for Park Rose School District. And I'm also a planning and sustainability commissioner for the city of Portland. I've been in education for the last 35 years and a superintendent for the last 12. Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee, and we're here to talk about Senate Bill 709. The changes to student transfers over the last 4 years and the forthcoming sunset of the open enrollment law has led to lots of discussion amongst educators across Oregon about the way that we allow children to go in and out of school districts and transfer. We've had interdistrict transfer for years and years, And as a superintendent, I've had lots of experience with that, both in the Coos Bay School District and also in Portland. Then we had open enrollment came in 2011, and then more changes were made to open enrollment, and Morgan is going to give you a much more thorough history than I will. We absolutely support the major tenet regarding anti-discrimination in the way that we have students transferring from district to district and disagree with cherry-picking of students. Aaron Prince, Darren Drill, and myself were asked by COSA to convene a work group of our colleagues and have a discussion about student transfers in Oregon. We created a work group of about 25 people across the state from different kinds of school districts, and we've met over the last year. We've had a number of in-person meetings via email, et cetera, and then also involved different colleagues that were not superintendents in the work group, also across the state of Oregon, so lots and lots of people. We approach the work with the following principles. Number one, how do we ensure that the needs of all students in Oregon are considered when making any proposed changes? Number two, how do we ensure all students who want to transfer are given an equal opportunity without discrimination? And number three, how do we create a compromise proposal that looks for the common ground and common agreement rather than extreme positions? And so as we've been doing our work for the last year, there are several common themes that have appeared and coalesced together throughout all of these statewide discussions. Number one is that having two processes, that is open enrollment and interdistrict transfer, is creating confusion for students, parents, and administrators. Number two, school districts would prefer a seamless single system, even if we don't all agree about all of the components, as you will see. There needs to be more standardization of the transfer process so all districts are on the same timeline, governed by the same rules, and using the same formats. And there needs to be more flexibility for the needs of students who encounter unforeseen circumstances in their lives and individual hardships. We have a proposal for your consideration that we believe fits these principles. While we have heard some singular reasons why some question parts of this proposal, the vast majority of school districts support this change. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Morgan to more firmly describe this proposal to you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association here in support of the idea of creating a new seamless system for student transfers in Oregon's K-12 system. And I just reiterate a couple things that have already been heard, and I've talked to some of the charter folks. No intention to touch the charter law or virtual charter law or have any impact to their operations. Similar for tuition. Tuition and charters are in separate statutes, and then that is not our intent to get into that discussion. And I think Senator Gelser did a good job of sort of highlighting a few of the things. And so to make sure that everyone gets a chance to testify, I did submit some written testimony describing sort of the history since 2011. Remember, 2011, we created open enrollment. 2013, we changed the interdistrict transfers. Also in 2013, the legislature came in on a strong bipartisan vote and made some changes to open enrollment. There were some practices people were concerned about, advertising, only taking kids from certain areas, things like that. You guys put some sideboards on that. And then as Senator Gelser mentioned, in 2013, we came back and tried to clean up some of the things from the interdistrict transfers, specifically to make sure that kids who'd previously had transfers moved to the front of the line, and that students are able to finish out the academic year. So within my testimony, I put 15, and I won't go through all 15 of them, but so you have a chance to read sort of the things that we're proposing. Again, things you've heard, a standardized timeline, using equitable lottery, continuing those limits on marketing with state school funds money, making sure that districts have to accept students with whatever characteristics they have, wherever they're from, making sure that all the students who've previously transferred or gone through open enrollment or all that stuff are grandfathered and don't have to reapply, standardizing the forms and the rules. One of the things we see is some districts do interdistrict transfers, some do open enrollment, some do both, some do neither. We want to make sure there's one standard system, making sure that FAPE and the responsibility for those kids transfers to those students, mentioned the fixes to the summer moves, and making sure that if students, once you get a transfer and you continue to move into different districts, that you do not have to come back and get a new transfer every time you move to a different community. So I think what we've tried to do, and I know you're going to hear some other ideas, and we're certainly willing to have conversations with folks about how to do this, but I think the most important thing that we've learned over the last year is that right now we have six distinctive pathways that kids can transfer on, and that is creating some confusion, and having both a transfer system and an open enrollment system is creating confusion. We want to make sure that all districts are open, but I think one of the things I'd like to just bring up is I think part of the discussion we have had what I would consider a little bit of the wrong conversation in the legislature over the last few years about transfers. We tend to focus on the kids that would like to go somewhere else or have some circumstances in their life that come up that would necessitate perhaps a different opportunity. And I think that's absolutely appropriate, and parents should be looking for those opportunities. But the conversation we haven't had is what happens when kids leave a class or a school or a school district and go somewhere else. And we're trying to find that balance between meeting the needs of students who want a different opportunity or might have something more appropriate in a different school district, but we also need to have a conversation about what happens to the programs and the opportunities for the kids that want to stay in their resident districts and make sure that they have those opportunities. Because, you know, if a small school district loses a few kids, that can have a huge impact on the school budget. If the elementary school loses 10 or 15 kids, that's the equivalent of a classroom teacher in that school. That has an impact on all the kids in those schools. So we're trying to find a balance where districts are open, kids can move around. We have flexibility to look at circumstances and hardships, and I will not spend a bunch of time. You have an opportunity to read some more details and specific in my written testimony. So I appreciate the opportunity. Happy to answer any questions.
Senator Gelser.
Siblings and hardships.
Yes. I forgot those. Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Senator Roblin, and I have a couple of things here. We want to make sure that siblings aren't separated, so we would like to have some provisions so that siblings would get preference or be able to move. You know, because of the way the system works now, where it's essentially equitable lotteries and blind admission, and you can't ask the characteristics and things like that, we want to make sure the districts can get that information and make sure those kids come in. And what was the other one?
Hardships.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. And right now, currently in the inter-district, one of the challenges in inter-district transfers, there is some language about hardships, but the way that the Department of Ed has, I think, appropriately interpreted those statutes, it's a pretty high bar. It'd have to be a pretty extreme circumstance where a superintendent or a principal could pick up the phone and call someone in another district and say, I have a kid who's being bullied, and they might need, you know, a fresh start, or they need a different place to go for their own safety and things like that. So we want to make sure that the department has some flexibility to look at those types of situations that arise in children's lives.
Any questions for this group? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So next we will call Zachary, Matthew, and Bobby Jaeger. There was a pattern with the last names. So
yeah, we're kind of all related.
We do what we can.
Okay, Matt, why don't you go first?
Chair Roblin and committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I am here to oppose the Senate Bill 709. For the record,
identify yourself.
He's getting
it. Yeah. For the record, my name is Matthew Jaeger.
There we go.
I have had the privilege of using open enrollment this year, and so have many of my other siblings in the past. Open enrollment has helped my educational life immensely. I currently attend high school as a ninth grader in the McMinnville School District, even though I live in the Willamina School District. I did not just choose randomly which school to go to. I weighed the two schools and gave this problem a lot of thought and consideration. And as you already know, I made the decision to attend school in the McMinnville School District. For the reasons that McMinnville has a numerous amount of advanced placement classes, and something else that separates the two schools is that McMinnville is involved in something called the Pathway Program. This unique program is only used in a few select schools. It helps every student start to see what they're interested in while they're still in high school. And it also helps them see what they want to study in the future. Within each pathway are different classes. So, for example, I would like to become an attorney, so I choose the criminal justice pathway. I do specific classes that have to do with that, and when I complete this pathway, then I will have the opportunity to be considered for a scholarship. This is only two of the great programs that are offered at McMinnville High School. I have been able to experience them both, and they are not offered in the school district of Willamina. By taking away open enrollment, you not only take away opportunities, but you also take away our right to choose the education which best fits us. Again, I urge you and plead that you realize the repercussions of the bill being passed, so I ask you, as someone with experience, while fully knowing that I would not be where I am today without open enrollment. So please don't take away our right to choose the best education possible for us. I strongly hope and recommend that you vote against this bill being passed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My turn. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for your service and giving me the opportunity to speak today about Senate Bill 709. My name is Zach Jaeger. I am a senior currently attending McMinnville High School. At McMinnville, I am able to fill several leadership positions, assist the community, and partake in various opportunities that would not have been available had I been kept in the Willamina School District. In my school, I've been an officer in the Kiwanis Club, or the Key Club, doing service and setting up blood drives. I also serve as president of the International Club, which is the largest club in the high school, representing over 150 McMinnville High School students, 13 exchange students, and 7 countries. This year, I was also chosen as captain of the McMinnville cross-country team. As a result of great coaching and being placed in a competitive league at McMinnville School District, I was able to participate in the state meet for the 6A division. In addition to that, I was able to become one of the Mr. Mack High guys, which is a group of juniors and seniors that auditioned to become a part of a pageant group that raised thousands of dollars for Dornbecker Children's Hospital throughout the year. On April 18th, we will be putting on a pageant that will be broadcasted to the children of Dornbecker. I also just returned back from my annual spring break mission trip to Mexico, where we built 4 houses for families through the Amor Ministries organizations. But still, my greatest accomplishment is my education. My whole life, I've focused my efforts on achieving the greatest education possible. One of my greatest fears has always been that a system will hold me back from reaching my full potential. When I couldn't go any further with my education being homeschooled, I switched to the Sheridan Japanese School, a charter school with a slightly accelerated learning curriculum. While I was there, I was able to get into a math program over 2 summers that allowed me to get an extra year ahead in math. Because of this, I was able to test into the Engineering and Aerospace Science Academy as a freshman. Over the years, I kept the fullest and most accelerated class load I could. Because of the classes I was able to take and the relationships I was able to develop with teachers, I was nominated and received the Rentschler Medalist Scholarship, an award given to the most advanced junior in math and science who was involved in extracurriculars and in the top 10% of their class. These are just some of the major accomplishments I've been able to achieve as a result of open enrollment. It was not easy to pursue the highest education possible, even when I didn't have to worry about getting permission to attend schools that I wanted to. With closed enrollment, I may not have gotten approval to go to Sheridan Japanese School or McMinnville High School. I would have lost all these opportunities to learn and serve as I settled for a lesser education. Living out of the district that I attend, school isn't easy. I drive close to 70 miles each day just to get to school and back home. That's not easy, but my parents have always supported me in this until I was able to get a license and a job and support myself. To summarize my point, students who wish to achieve the greatest education and have access to benefits that best suit them should be allowed that chance, regardless of where they live, without having to worry about approval. It is my belief that this bill will lead to unnecessary stress, discouragement, and missed opportunities. Not all students are born in the best school districts or have the opportunity to relocate to a better area. So for students like me and for the future generations, I ask that you vote no on Senate Bill 709. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and committee, thanks for your service and your time. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my concerns today on Senate Bill 709. For the record, my name is Bobby Jaeger, and some of you know I'm the executive director and president of BEST, Building Excellent Schools Together. I am also Oregon's Mother of the Year for 2012, but my most important role is mother to these 13 children, and grandmom or nana, depending on who's talking to me, of 14 children. 2 of my sons are seated with me today. They are the product of the system, the same system we are putting on the table today. From the beginning of my adventure of motherhood, education has been my passion. I started my children out with core beliefs and structure: good, bad, true, false, wrong, right.
These were very important to get down into their hearts before worldly learning could go on. This was their foundation, a place that they too would set their pegs to then judge. One of the most important principles that we taught was choice and decisions. Our family motto has a saying, decisions determine your destiny. Senate Bill 709 is taking that away for us. As you have heard and you can see, these two young men have made conscious decisions about their future. We have raised our children to have ownership over their own education. If homework did not get done, grades would be poor, which would result in missed opportunities of life somewhere down the road. If you did not work hard and give a full day's work for a full day's pay, you could not be counted on, and your reputation would reflect this. We teach our children a man's character is like his house. If he tears boards off his house and burns them to keep himself warm and comfortable, his house soon becomes a ruin. Senate Bill 709 brought our family, the whole family, to their feet. Through educating my children, I have homeschooled, charter schooled, public schooled, private schooled, and online schooled. So I have been an active participant in the enrollment process on both sides. Every year I would put in with one district, and then I waited, always worried and anxious to hear if, yes, one more year, we could go ahead with the plan for that child. Having 13 children and them being individuals, the same plan that worked for child number one would not work necessarily for child number four, and so on. So it was like a fine blueprint plan that I had. I would work on to ensure that their education was tailored to fit them. And what might have worked for one year would not always be available for the next. And challenges and growth would make that change. You can imagine my joy when open enrollment was granted. Hooray, I thought, finally. They are understanding these are decisions that affect people, my people, and yes, many others. So you can also imagine my horror when I read Senate Bill 709. Education is moving, or should I say, trying to move forward, but this bill is definitely not a forward move. We teach leadership in our home. We teach that leadership is not a position, but helping others have vision, discipline, passion, and conscience. Helping others to see their potential and opportunities and then getting out of their way. Managing is something we do with objects and things. Senate Bill 709 is managing, but not objects. It's managing people and their lives. I believe it does not matter why a mom decides to move her child, but I do believe it matters to her. A trim tab is a small rudder that turns the big rudder on a boat or a plane that turns the entire ship around. Moms are trim tabs. You too can be a trim tab today on Senate Bill 709 and help. Help teach leadership to Oregon by letting families make the choice of where their child goes to school for their success. Be my trim tab as my sons today learn that this is where we can handle concerns and issues for our government, and that this is their building, that one day they will sit in your chairs and make decisions for your family. I hope you vote no on Senate Bill 709.
Thank you. Question, Senator Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's more of a clarification.
Okay.
I think the testimony illustrates part of the problem that we have.
Okay.
Our statute lists out multiple ways that kids can move among districts.
Mm-hmm.
Open enrollment is one of them.
Okay.
This bill doesn't amend that part of the statute. One of the other ways that kids move is in the interdistrict transfer statute that existed prior to open enrollment. After an open enrollment passed, one of the things that I learned, was that some districts were behaving in what I believe were discriminatory ways in terms of how they were allowing students to move. Which is why last session we had the bill that changed interdistrict transfer to make it more open. Senate Bill 709 does not touch the open enrollment statute, and it's not intended to touch the open enrollment statute. So if there's a part that does, let us know so we can get it out. But it's intended to allow more students to move even if the districts aren't participating in open enrollment.
So nobody has to accept or give permission to leave?
In this bill, we are requiring every district in the state to allow some students to leave.
Allow some.
Right now, in inter-district transfer, districts can decide to allow nobody to leave in inter-district transfer.
They can also do that for open enrollment.
Right. I guess
all or none.
I guess my biggest concern is it depends on what district you come from.
It
okay,
even does now. Yep.
Yeah, and where that district is in what they want to control. Because right now, the way it is, we've just gone for the last 4 years. But through the 27 years, I've done the put it in, wait for the response, put it in, and wait. But this has been the greatest success that we've had with public school.
And that's what we're trying to fix. This bill doesn't change that. Open enrollment in the statute is not touched. That continues. We'll have that conversation in the next session
right.
when the sunset comes up.
Mm-hmm.
What this does right now in inter-district transfer, District A might say, I will take in 50 kids to my district, but I'm not going to let anybody leave. If this bill passes, it would say you have to let at least 3% of your students leave, even if you're not taking anybody in. And if you're taking kids in, you have to let go at least 3% or 50 kids.
But what if we were 3.5%?
What?
What if we were the 3.5%?
Well, and again, it would depend on how many they were letting out. But if you were the 3.5%, open enrollment wouldn't change. So you would still be able to go. This bill isn't changing open enrollment. This is about a different system, which is inter-district transfer, and it's opening it up more, making it much more like open enrollment.
Okay,
but if this bill passes, nothing will change with open enrollment.
Okay.
But in the regard to that, if this bill works, there are people who would say, well, maybe we don't need to extend the sunset. So it's always good to be
yeah,
around.
Right.
And to be coachable.
We just want to make sure we keep what we have. Don't change
it. I got
it.
You.
So we understand.
You.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. We're going to have one more panel. There'll be some people who won't be able to speak today because we're running out of time. But I will call up Jennifer Cambus and Aaron Prince and Darren Drill. And because of the way we've been going back, we'll let those two speak first because they're four, and then we'll go with you.
Half my questions have already been answered.
Okay.
If I just sit here a little longer, maybe I can leave.
So, Aaron, you or Darren can go first.
All right. I'll start. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and committee members. My name is Aaron Prince, Superintendent of Corvallis. I have served with Superintendents Drill and Gray as co-chair of this committee charged with finding a solution to a very confusing and complex inter-district and open enrollment process. We recognize that it is critical to have one system that is predictable, clear, and consistent for districts and families. One system that creates timelines and processes that assist in budgeting and staffing supports for districts. We also attempted to strike a balance between those desiring a change in districts and those remaining in their home district. Our region, Corvallis, Lebanon, Philomath, Albany, has historically accepted and released any student who desired a transfer. However, we also realize that even our practices in Corvallis, while unintentional, were discriminatory in not accepting students with high-cost disabilities if a releasing district was not willing to pay additional costs. This is a funding issue, not a student issue. The intent of the combination of the bills is to break down those barriers that create the haves and the have-nots and level the playing field. This becomes an equity issue that needs to be at the forefront of our decision-making. One size does not fit all in our system. As you hear testimony today, I would challenge you as a committee to ask the questions. Does every student have a choice? Does every student have access to transfer to another district? Or are there barriers set up to block this choice based on disability, based on language, based on what neighborhood they live in? Based on their ability to pay tuition or not pay tuition? We are public education, and we are about serving all kids. Our attempt here is to streamline the process and, most importantly, ensure the equity for all students.
Good afternoon, Senator Roblin and chair members. My name is Darren Drill. I'm the superintendent at Cascade School District, just southeast here of Salem. And again, I was part of this process with regard to sitting down with Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and having a year-long conversation about how it is we can deal with inter-district transfers. Again, I'd like to reiterate that most of the superintendents, while you can never get a group of superintendents to agree on everything at one time, most of us agree that these changes are a positive direction for the inter-district transfer process. We have come to the conclusion that for many superintendents, some of this was confusing as it was for parents, as you've heard today. And the bottom line was we felt that these changes cleaned up some of that process. Again, this is only about the inter-district transfer piece of it, and one of the concerns as I had as a small school district was the number of kids that would leave a district without finances to continue to help the students that stay. And one of the concerns we ended up talking about was being able to put a cap on, Senator Gelser mentioned a 3% cap or some sort of cap so that we can handle it. I understand the process that students want to leave to maybe go to a better place. In their minds, they might think that's better. But what it leaves are kids, mostly kids that are financially unable to make that move, have to stay. And the goal of trying to find that balance is to make sure that the ones that stay still have finances to be able to have programs so they can be successful. One of the things that we notice at Cascade as we share space with Jefferson, Staten, and Salem is that over the years we've been able to pass back and forth kids based on if you want to go somewhere else, that's fine. I am literally 7.5 miles from Sprague High School. Cascade High School has 700 kids. Sprague High School has 2,200 kids. You can imagine that Sprague might offer a few additional things that Cascade does not. What we also notice, however, is that some Sprague kids come back to Cascade because those parents feel like their kids have fallen through the cracks. And so a smaller school might be able to identify kids and keep track of them a little bit better. I don't offer orchestra, but I do offer a way for all of our teachers and my principal to identify kids by name and by face in that high school. So the balance gets struck. A number of our colleagues were concerned that by losing kids, particularly from rural areas to larger, bigger schools, that they would be able to lose the funding that goes with those students to be able to offer viable, good opportunities for kids that stay. We believe that this bill allows us to have a balance there. It also allows time for a district, because some people might suggest that, well, you know what, if kids are leaving your district, you better make your district a little bit better. This allows a little bit of time for the district to work at making it better, getting a chance to re-up and get better at what we're trying to do. So quickly to wrap up, this provides a clearer way for us to handle the inter-district transfer process. We believe, as in most superintendents, believe that this is a way for us to get that clarity and allow students and parents to understand what is best for their kid and allow them to have that happen. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and the remaining 1.5 members of the committee. I'm kidding. No.
Gotta go.
We're going to take all the testimony because there is no committee coming in after here. Usually, we have to be out about 5 minutes ago, and they have other businesses going on.
I always try to, you know, I've testified before the education committee years ago when all this started. So it's like always, yeah. My name is Jennifer Combas, and my daughter Elizabeth is in a district virtual school. Out of Lebanon, Oregon High School, but we're up in the Beaverton School District. And I came down because I was concerned about inter-district transfers. I've lived through, my daughter went to the brick and mortar elementary school. We loved it. And her teachers told me, she's not a good fit for the middle school. And that's when we found ORVA, and that's when the virtual school journey began. When she entered high school, Oregon High School was opened out of Lebanon, and then I had to deal with inter-district transfers out of Beaverton School District. And I'm not dumb, but I ended up having to call down to the person who wrote the legislation that allowed inter-district transfers to call the Beaverton School District and explain that they had to let us go. I am afraid that if we start, I've been through so much of trying to get her into the school districts or places that she needs. I'm afraid that if we start messing again, I mean, I only have so many hours in the day to educate people, you know, the school districts. And Beaverton is very large, and I have been working with them for years to get a virtual program, and they don't have one yet, or a blended things that fit students. So I'm just concerned, frankly, because my daughter's a junior, and she's got 1 year left, and then she'll be able to actually do the beyond, I don't know if you, the Beyond Lebanon High School, so then she can do the 2 years mm-hmm. at the community college. And it's just, you know, it's a tough road. And I was kind of wanting clarification as well regarding the inter-district and the caps, because Beaverton is gigantic. A 3% cap, I mean, that's, you're done. I mean, you know, people just drop it hanky and it's 3%. So I'm also afraid for that cap, because we had a cap and then we couldn't get out either. There was a 3% cap before. So I'm concerned about the cap, and I'd kind of like clarification about the inter-district for virtual.
Okay. And we'll have more information about that as time goes on, because this bill is a work in progress.
Yeah. Okay. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the story of my life.
So with that, we will call up our last group, Laura Dillon, Terry Brandon, and Mark Thielman. And again, the reason some people are gone is they had other appointments. We found out our committee that follows us is not here today, so we have a little bit of time, and I will take the testimony. So if other people have to go, they have to go.
I apologize. I've got to go to more.
That's right.
Oh,
last. Mark, thank
you.
Yeah, I think he has. So whoever wants to start.
Oh, you're both looking at me. There you go.
They've heard us talk before.
Oh, okay. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here today and share about Oregon Connections Academy and how we inform students and families about Oregon, around Oregon, about our school. I do want to say initially that we really appreciate the supporters of this bill offering amendments to clarify that this legislation doesn't apply to charter schools or online schools, and we look forward to working with you to accomplish that. And I just want to, I'm talking specifically about Section 7, and if you would like me to speak about that, I can, or I can turn it over to these gentlemen.
I think Senator Gelser would like to know what the concern is. So.
Okay, thank
and
you.
And may I just say, I'm sure. going to walk out in a minute, and it's not because of what anybody's saying.
Sure.
I'm chairing a meeting in the other room.
Exactly.
And Mrs. Hatfield is
talking, so. Sure, I know you're very busy. Well, I just wanted to share some thoughts with you about how this bill might impact some families at our school. My name is Laura Dillon, and I'm the Parent Outreach Manager here at Oregon Connections Academy. I've had 18 years of teaching experience, and I do love working with students and their families who are in need of another option here in Oregon. I've had the privilege of traveling around Oregon and informing families about our school. I inform them with information sessions, different events, fairs, parent meetings, just an array of different activities. Many of our families enrolled in our school, they've heard about us through some sort of ad or, if you will, some type of invitation to become aware of our school as an option for their child. This can be through a Google search, a direct mail piece, TV, radio, print ad, or different avenues of communication. Without these invitations, parents really wouldn't know about our school, possibly, and consequently wouldn't have the option for their student. For example, we have a family in Hillsboro that learned about ORCA through a postcard that they received in the mail. Paula, who's the mom and the learning coach, she told me that, quote, through schooling with ORCA, we found that our kids benefited with one-on-one instruction, and each one has prospered with ORCA. They've had a couple of students that are hard of hearing, that with that one-on-one instruction, it's helped them develop into better students and find success. She also has her youngest daughter has some medical issues, and so with the flexibility, it's helped her daughter achieve what she needs to achieve in the fourth grade. farther out in rural Oregon, eastern Oregon. There's a family with a sophomore and an eighth grader who's enrolled in ORCA, and they came to us about 5 years ago. They also received a postcard in the mail. The mom was able then to do some more research about our school through our website. She attended an information session, got to meet some parents, look at the curriculum, talk to the teachers, and she knew that that was going to be a good fit. And she told me that, quote, we were at our wits' end. The kids' old school wasn't working for us, and when we got the postcard in the mail about ORCA, we decided to check it out, and it's been godsend ever since. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, you've heard about a couple of our families around Oregon, and our families hear about us through many different mediums. And because we're a statewide school, they can't just talk to their neighbors about the school down the street, go visit the school, walk in, see the curriculum, and then register their child. So it's important that all families around Oregon are able to learn about other opportunities for schooling for their child, and then let them make the decision if it's going to work for their child. Virtual school students represent 171 different school districts in Oregon. Virtual school enrollments are capped at 3%, as we've talked about, per statute. And currently, the total out-of-district students enrolled in virtual learning is less than 1.5%. We encourage you to see us as a solution for students in districts who may need a unique program for a particular student's needs. We'd also appreciate the opportunity to efficiently address all areas of Oregon through the responsible use of advertising. In order to start the conversations with families about educational options that may or may not fit their students' needs, we see advertising as just the first step, the invitation, bringing awareness, and helping families and students make an informed decision. We've learned that the more families are informed about our school prior to enrolling, it's a better fit for the child, and student academic success increases. Thank you.
Thank you. So you get me to talk to, but it becomes a permanent record, so they'll check on it. So thanks.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee that are here. My name is Terry Brandon. I'm the superintendent of Riverdale School District. I come to Oregon. This is my second year after 39 years as a superintendent administrator in Washington. I was also on the COSA committee that brought forth the ideas around the legislation that make up Senate Bill 709. So I'm signed up to speak against it. That's probably a bit of an overstatement. I'm speaking against parts of it. One of the things that I'm concerned about is the concept of the cap. To say that a district has to have a balance between those two, I think is problematic. Riverdale fortunately has more people that want to come in than want to leave. We have a standing policy that allows anyone who wants to go somewhere else to be able to go. We support that. We support parent choice. We support parents deciding what's best for their kids. This year, we just completed our second year of the implementation of 2747 and 4007 that had been modified. It went smoothly without a hitch. However, we had about 150 to 180 kids wanting to come in, and we only had about six kids that wanted to leave. So we were able to accommodate about 36 children. We are wide open to say you can leave, but we'd like to be wide open to say you can come in too, to the extent of our classroom capability. I think that, I know there's lots of amendments that are coming up about this, and hopefully one of those amendments would be to allow districts that have an open out policy to be able to accept whatever happens to come in, rather than stick to some type of 3% cap that is, frankly, I've read the bill, I have a background in law, I find it very difficult to understand. And so it's just one of those clarification things, and I guess I'm a bit of a minority report on the from the committee, but I support the work that's been done. There's great things in the bill. There's a lot of technical fixes to problems that, while they don't occur in Riverdale because we don't have the quantity of kids, they do occur in other districts. But I think we can get closer on this. So I did submit some written testimony, but as I listen, I'm kind of speaking freely here. So thank you. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Senator Roblin.
Mark.
Hi. Mark Thielman for the record, ALSEI superintendent. And if anyone asks, my school board told me to get up here and speak. Two things. First of all, we have to deal with bills as they're written. And this bill, I'm on the committee as well. The committee was designed to merge open enrollment and inter-district transfer, so I want to clarify that because there seemed to be some discussion that this only addresses inter-district transfer. One begats the other. It has all the amendments that were added to the open enrollment bill to restrict my ability to advertise or run a dedicated bus or do things that all the charter public schools get to do. But don't worry, that's a separate statute. And it's this kind of confusion and comedy that makes me, when I first read this law, and I'll be a little bit more direct, maybe I could model for you. On, okay. You're so gracious. I thought this was a screenplay for the new MSNBC reality TV series Control Freaks. But that's what this bill does. It's trying to micromanage. And today was the first day I heard that we were going to mandate that districts have to open up. Right here in this hearing, it's the first I've heard of it. And I'm on the hearing now. In terms of extreme positions, yeah, I took an extreme position in the committee. There are already open enrollment rules. We have a whole state north of us that does parent choice. It's called parent choice. And so all districts are open, and there's some restrictions on it. And we have zero conversations when I used to administrate in Washington about these issues. You can run a bus in Washington if you decide into another district, if you have enough kids and so on and so forth, and districts work it out. Okay, so for me, I run a bus, but I can run a bus currently with inter-district transfer kids. I can go pick them up, and it's legal under current law for me to receive funding to do so. If this passes because it merges in the open enrollment thing, then inter-district transfer kids that currently have that right now no longer have that right. Basically, I'm out the funding. These are real issues. But the bill also says that kids can operate under established routes. But my established routes go into my neighbors and pick up kids. So there's a whole host of issues here, and I call it an equity and equal access issue. In ALSEI, we're in the middle of nowhere. If anybody ever been there? There's more fish than people. Okay? So I have to bus. And I have all kinds. I had three new students sign up today. They signed up to come to my school next year under the open enrollment. They called. And at the same time, I told their parents to go pick up inter-district transfer forms. Just in case, because I'm not allowed to ask, those kids want to play sports because we have the OSAA who says if you're inter-district transfer or if you're open enrollment because the home district didn't technically release you or get a say in releasing you, you have to wait a year to play sports. But inter-district transfer kids, okay, you can play, but you have to have a summer break between the school years. Well, that summer break between the school years is the same rule that public charter schools have to follow, and they're open year-round. So just real quick for the record, a couple of facts. We've been doing this for 3 years, open enrollment. Where are the major front page articles about major programs that have been shut down because of an exodus of kids? See, I want to know facts, not fear. There's a lot of fear that gets stated. We've had fear stated in our committee, and we need to really kind of get over it. Tremendous amount of energy is going to be spent on this, and we're a third of the way through the session, and there's going to be multiple amendments. I'm concerned. So with that, I'll just stop. I think I covered all my school board's points.
Thank you. Any questions?
I have no.
So is there anyone else that hasn't spoken? Thank you all for being here. Is there anybody else that wanted to? They've been holding themselves in their chairs, and it's been unbearable, and now they want to get up and speak. This is the time. Otherwise, I'll say thank you all for that, and we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 709. Is that the one?
Carry over 619.
And we'll carry over Senate Bill 619. And with that, we will adjourn our Senate Education Committee today on the 31st. Thanks all for being here.